Good morning. So the class is about Latin, why, and then how to do it in the 21st century. And let me start by introducing myself. My name is Troy Simons. I'm the headmaster at Oak Grove Classical Academy in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I've been teaching our Latin for the last 3 years. I didn't teach it our first year. I taught it our second, third, and fourth, and I'm going to continue to teach just our Latin 1. I fortunately have a lady now who is a little further along than I am in Latin, and she's joining us. But I love Latin. I love the language, and I have wrestled for some time with that component of Latin in classical education, and so we'll flesh some of that out. Let me see how many of you here are Latin teachers. Anybody? Okay. Who do we have represented here? What do you do in your school? Third grade. Okay. English.
At.
Yes, I know your pain. Admin. Okay. Okay, very good. And how many of you are in classical schools? Everybody? Transitioning maybe?
Modified?
Okay, very good, very good. So what I hope to accomplish today really is not anything, I guess, super, super concrete, to be honest with you. There's a conversation, obviously, that we're in the midst of as educators, both within and without the class, inside the classical tradition and outside the classical tradition. And there's a sense in which I think we're all very far outside the classical tradition because it's not a tradition. It's something that we're trying to revive. We're looking really kind of back to the days of old when students were trained classically. And we know that that's part of our American heritage, that really from the time that people started to arrive here and really establish colonies, up until about the Civil War, there really was kind of nothing else but classical education. And there really was nothing else but Latin and Greek. So we live really in a very different day, a very different time. What would you say is king in our educational theory today? Who can throw out some buzzwords for us in academic theory? Math and science, okay, yeah, very strong. Math and science is king, right? Core knowledge, yeah, that's that. Edie Hirsch, yeah, I believe, core knowledge. What else? Any other things come to mind? Then let me ask this. College prep, okay, yes, definitely. College prep and all the things related to that. Do you ever hear Latin in that mix in those lists and descriptions? Yeah, we really don't. But, you know, pre-Civil War, you would have almost heard nothing else but Latin and Greek. That those were really the central core of everything they did. Latin, Greek, and math made up the heart of the classical curriculum. So that's an interesting context to think of the seven humanities, which of course are the curriculum of classical education. Grammar, logic, rhetoric, math, astronomy, geometry, and music. Take those into the context of Latin and Greek, and you have something that is pretty radically different from where we're at today. So, you know, my attempt to answer that question, why Latin, and well, there's still Greek in there too, right? And then how to do it in the 21st century. That's a difficult question to answer, which is why I say, I'm not going to necessarily have you come away with a real concrete plan of how I can go back to my school and I can just like totally scrape everything off and then start this new program that's going to look like pre-American Civil War times, and we're going to do this great education. That's obviously not something that we can do. How many of you have kind of been in this conversation about Latin and why we would pursue it? Have you read the books or heard the arguments? If you stopped by the booths downstairs, Martin Cothran with, Press? Yes, Memoria. Do you guys get these? These, you know, you can sign up for these and they'll send them to your house for free. There's some great little articles in here. He was telling me that they print an outrageous number of these for the size of a publisher that they are. And it's really kind of encouraging. And I think that they have such a broad circulation because they do a good job at writing articles. But one of the things that you'll find in these is Cheryl Lowe, who's the Right. So that's my wife, and she's asking the question that really, it's interesting, our whole board is here, and that's something that we've been wrestling with the different speakers that we've been hearing. We've had some great conversations after some of the talks that we're having. And I don't know that there's an immediate straight line to just draw to that, because this is the same education that the pagans had. This is also the same education that Augustine had. And Augustine's an interesting combination. He had a pagan father, Christian mother. He was pagan for the first part of his life. He was Christian for the second part of his life. Who is arguably the most influential theologian of Western history? If you read if you read the Puritans, if you read Calvin's Institutes, if you read Luther and all of these guys, they all point back to one guy as being the main guy, and that's Augustine. So he's an interesting bridge between the two. This is an education that could, you know, make a really great pagan, and it can make a really great Christian. And when I say a really great pagan, I don't mean to laud the glories of paganism. I'm saying that it produced great minds among the pagans, and it produced great minds among Christians. And you don't have to have a great mind to be a great Christian. Some of the godliest people that I've ever known have been the simplest, most backwoods kind of people who just love their Bibles because they love their God and it teaches them about Him, and they, you know, and it's just very real. But I will say that the people who have been the most influential, the life changers, have been men and women who have an uncanny ability to understand, to go deep into something and then turn around and explain that. If you read the writings of the Puritans, it's interesting. They do quote Augustine, and they do quote Calvin and Luther and Plotinus and Aristotle and Epictetus and all of these other pagan people, right? We didn't even talk about the connection to we didn't flesh out the connection to literature, which is that it's the connection not only to the Christian tradition, but it's the connection to pagan literature written by pagans, where they pursued the same things that we've heard in some of these other sessions of truth and beauty and goodness. And listen, if something is truly true, it's God's truth. If something is truly good, it's God's goodness. It's a reflection of God, who is the ultimate definition of good, right? And beauty, if something's truly beautiful, it's because God has made it thus. And there's really, I think there's an absurdness to the idea that there's not truth, beauty, and goodness in language and literature outside of the Christian tradition, because there is not, that's a false dichotomy. There's no such thing as a different kind of truth. Now granted, it's sometimes a minefield. And that logical mind and that discerning mind, I believe it was Aristotle, maybe it was Plato, who said that the mark of an educated mind is to be able to entertain a thought without necessarily accepting it. That's the power of discernment. So the influence of Latin and Greek historically has been the means by which that mind has been produced. And I think, to go back to my wife's question, the connection that we have with our students in all of these things is that what is our motive behind producing that mind? One of the common criticisms of the classical movement is that it just produces a bunch of arrogant pigs who think themselves so far superior. If you think that, a great class would have been to go to Troy Schuchnert, is that you? Next door, right? He talked about the gospel and making it the centerpiece of everything that we do. Would you have a better grasp, a better mind to wrestle with the gospel if it was trained by these things? Do you think you'll have a better grasp of the gospel if you can pick up a Bible in Koine Greek and read through it? Or the Latin Vulgate and read through it? and see the connection with words. Do you know that at an academic level, and Kopf really does a great job at bringing this out, it started in the 60s and 70s where literary criticism was basically just dismantling language, just basically saying there's no way to know truth. That idea that's so prevalent today that there is no absolute truth. If there is absolute truth, we can't know it. If it can't be known, it can't be communicated. That's foundational to the educational system today. Do you believe that? And you know where it began? It began with literary criticism. It began because people don't have a grasp on this to be able to look at people like that and say, you're out of your mind. You're out of your mind, and I can show you why you're out of your mind. Come here. Right? We're just not equipped. And that avoidance of mediocrity that was such a strong goal for classical educators of old, was so vital to them because they know the human heart, that the tendency is for us to think like, I took the class. Yeah, I know. Right? I got an A+ on the test. I graduated summa cum laude. But when you really get down to brass tacks, does that person really know? Do they really know? And let's just be honest, to go back to, again, to my wife's question, there's a way that you can go about learning this that will most definitely puff us up, right? But I think in the presence of our God, and when Christ and the gospel and the cross are center to all things, and we recognize the fallen nature of our own person, and that this is something to take us greater into the knowledge and the understanding of God, then this can be a very humbling thing. I stand before the massive edifice of Latin and Greek, and I just feel like, whoa. It's amazing to me, but I feel humbled, super humbled. And the more I know of it, the more I realize that I don't know of it. And that's the same pattern that we should see in our pursuit of knowing Christ. There's one other aspect that I kind of wanted to do. I wanted to just give you reasons, you know, in the formation of the student, and we could just maybe sum that up as we are looking to build in them a quality of mind, a logical mind, a strong memory, that alacrity with facts and with being able to just put things together. The people who gave us formal logic spoke Greek. And to teach Greek or to teach Latin, which the structures of the two are very, very similar, is to ultimately give them the context, the matrix in which those rules for logic were figured out. And I think that there's a direct connection. You might argue differently, but I think that it is there. What flows out of that, and I'll do this real quick, I've got 4 minutes, is the connection that ultimately gives us to certainly the gospel, right, and the foundations of the gospel, and connecting them with the fact that the church was dropped right into the middle of Greek and Roman history. I shared in my Abolition of Man class yesterday that God chose to put his church right smack dab in the middle of a Greco-Roman world, right? He didn't choose to write his scriptures in Hebrew. He chose Greek, right? And it wasn't something that was out of his control. I really think that he chose that. And I pointed out also that whereas Rome conquered Greece militarily, Greece ultimately conquered Rome culturally. So the conqueror became the conquered. And it really was this melange of Greco-Roman culture, which is why the Romans even adopted all of the Greek gods and just gave them Roman names. And right, they were studying the Romans built their architecture based largely on Greek ideas from Vitruvius, the Greek architect, or he was a Roman who studied Greek architecture and wrote his 10-volume set. I think there's only 4 that we have that survived. What does it do when we connect the student with those things? Does anybody want to hazard a guess? Why would we be so keen to connect them to that Greco-Roman world? What will that do? Yes, ma'am. Right, right. I think, and there begins the conversation, right? So if we were in our classes with our students and we were doing this Socratically, we might just throw that question out there and let them kick it around for a little bit. And then we would add the next question in there of, what connection really do you think there is between then and now? What influence does that time then have on where we're at now? We might kick that around with our students for a little while and let them kind of think through that. And then we might get a little bit more specific and talk maybe about the thoughts of certain persons like Kikero. Or if we go back to Greek history and the beginning of democracy in Athens and throw out some of those ideas, right? And take the long road of discussing those things and having them just kind of think through and draw those things out. Ultimately, I think what we're going to find is that there is there's every connection to be made with where we are at right now coming from a Greco-Roman world. That Western thought, that Western culture, that Western architecture, go to the Capitol, for crying out loud. What was the inspiration for all of those buildings that were put up? Right? Jefferson read Vitruvius and his works on Greek and Roman architecture, right? And all of that thought is built into our very constitution and our laws and that Western tradition. Let me see if I wrote this out well. Historical precedent in all cultures of longevity, right? Cultures that have been around for a long time, comes from an active effort to be informed by the past. Cultural, national longevity comes from an active effort to be informed by the past. The poets were memorized for generations. Deuteronomy 6 commands to, in fact, throughout Deuteronomy, it commands the people of God to remember. Remember the Exodus. Remember the things that I have said. These things that I have taught are to be impressed on the heart. I don't claim to be a historian, but I will suggest that the demise of nations and kingdoms, right? Because nations is a newer word, kingdoms is an older word, right? The loss of them comes simultaneously with the loss of connection with the past. The man most equipped for the future is the one most informed by the past. Do not forget that nations are conquered not just by invading armies, but by invading ideas, and often the latter is followed by the former. I think that's why we should do Latin and Greek. And why we should strive with all sorts of effort to connect our students to the solid foundation of God's working in history. It starts from our understanding of the Scripture and the Gospel, and then it flows out from there. How did the church develop? Read church history and you will see this massive abrasion between paganism, and which was characteristic of not just the people in general, but the government of Rome and the church. And you'll see wrestling with the deity of Christ and all of these other elements that paganism tried to impose and enforce on Christianity, and Christianity just systematically overcame it with the proclamation of the gospel. And what was foundational to all of those people who fought the fight along the way, including the reformers. The reformers lived in a time when there was a massive revival of classical languages. And as the ideas are undermining our very civilization currently, when the loss of that historical idea that we've had in America of what it is to be a free citizen, and as everybody seems to be embracing the idea that the government can and should take care of us, that's ultimately indicative of a loss of connection with the past. I told my wife just a little bit ago, and we'll go. Rob Renau and Troy next door, and just hearing some of these guys speak so strong about our students' need for the gospel. I just felt like, man, I kind of wish I just signed up for something like that, because I love encouraging people to take the gospel embody the gospel for their students in their school and just make that gospel center to everything and burn down anything that would stand in the way of putting the gospel central. But I think you can also see and hear just the passion in my voice that this is part of it. This is part of it. This is a hard part of it to understand. I don't understand it. I came to converse with you as much as to try and inform you. So I hope that I've succeeded in some of that, at the very least. God bless you. Thanks.